Good morning. On today's programme, the First Nations referendum in Australia and the two-wheeled solution to the problem of school dropout rates in North Cameroon. But first we go to Canada, and that country grabbed international headlines over the last few weeks after members of the Parliament stood in the House of Commons and applauded a former member of a Nazi-led military unit from the Second World War. It was a faux pas that wasn't supposed to happen. There was outrage from Jewish groups. Poland's ambassador called it hurtful, and the Kremlin used it for political gain. It also led to a formal apology from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, and the Speaker of the House of Commons lost his job. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the incident came during an historic visit to Ottawa by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky.
The highly anticipated and well-publicized visit by Zelensky was a welcome event in Ottawa. Fresh from his address to the United Nations in New York and then a meeting at the White House, Zelensky traveled to Ottawa, where he addressed Canadian parliamentarians and selected guests in the House of Commons. But one of those guests was there at the invitation of the Speaker of the House of Commons, Anthony Rota. 98-year-old Yaroslav Honka was introduced as a Ukrainian war hero and a Canadian hero, a veteran from the Second World War who fought for Ukrainian independence against the Russians. Members of both houses of the Canadian Parliament rose and applauded. But what those members and guests weren't told was that Honka was a member of the 1st Ukrainian Division, previously called the 14th Waffen-Grenadier Division of the SS, also known as the 1st Galician Division. Jewish organizations such as the Simon Wiesenthal Center for Holocaust Studies were outraged and quickly pointed out that the 1st Galician Division was responsible for the mass murder of innocent civilians with a level of brutality and malice that is unimaginable. Jewish groups demanded an apology. In a statement, the Simon Wiesenthal Center said an apology is owed to every Holocaust survivor and veteran of the Second World War who fought against the Nazis. They also wanted an explanation why an individual who was a member of the unit was allowed into the Canadian Parliament and received recognition from the Speaker Anthony Rota, as well as a standing ovation. Bernie Farber, who heads the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, says there is no doubt that this division that Honka fought with and every other SS unit bears some responsibility for the killing of 6 million Jews. Farber says he's ashamed and disgusted that the Canadian Parliament would embrace and applaud a member of a Nazi SS unit. Opposition leaders in the House of Commons tried to lay the blame on Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, saying the incident was a failure of the vetting process which his government is responsible for. But Speaker Anthony Rota says no one was aware of his intention to invite Honka. He says he was solely responsible and invited him because he is a member of his constituency. The Prime Minister's office also said that Rota alone was responsible for inviting Honka. The Speaker's office is independent from the Prime Minister and his office, and had its own allotment of guests for the Zelensky event. They were determined by the Speaker and his office alone. When the political firestorm hit, Rota extended his deepest apologies to Jewish communities in Canada and around the world. He also apologized to members of the House of Commons and to Canadians. But Rota would not resign as Speaker despite growing calls from opposition leaders and in the days that followed from senior cabinet ministers of his own Liberal Party, including Foreign Affairs Minister Melanie Joly and Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. Trudeau didn't join those calls but said the incident was profoundly embarrassing. The controversy also played into the political posturing in Moscow. The Kremlin said it was outrageous that a Ukrainian who served in the SS had been presented to Canada's parliament as a hero. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said it showed a careless disregard for historical truth and that the memory of Nazi crimes must be preserved. He also called it a sloppiness of memory. Peskov said Russia was today waging an irreconcilable fight against fascism that was trying to have a resurgence in Ukraine. In Ottawa, Poland's ambassador called the invitation of Honka deeply hurtful, adding that Rota's apology doesn't go far enough to address the atrocities the 1st Galician Division was responsible for against Polish citizens during the war. He said this division committed mass killings of Polish citizens. Historians say the Galicia Division was originally created under Nazi command from Ukrainian volunteers and was also involved in the mass murder of Jews, Poles, and suppressing uprisings in Yugoslavia and Slovakia. After a meeting with House party leaders, Rota resigned. He really had little choice, and again apologized. And this week, Prime Minister Trudeau offered what he called unreserved apologies for Parliament's recognition of Honka. He also reached out to President Volodymyr Zelensky. He called it a mistake that deeply embarrassed Parliament and Canada, adding that all who were present regret deeply having stood and applauded, even though we did so unaware of the context. He also said the incident was a horrendous violation of the memory of the millions of people who died in the Holocaust. And he said Canada is sorry for the position it put Zelensky and the Ukrainian delegation in because of an egregious error, and then used by Russia and its supporters to amplify false narratives about what Ukraine is fighting for. The leader of the official opposition Conservative Party said Trudeau's apology wasn't enough, and the Prime Minister should take personal responsibility. Trudeau quickly fired back, asking why the party leader had not apologized for three of his MPs meeting with far-right German politician Christine Anderson earlier this year. The incident has also thrown a spotlight on a dark part of Canada's history and the presence of Nazi war criminals. B'nai B'rith wants all Holocaust-related records made public, including a heavily redacted commission report from 1986 on Canada's post-war admittance of Ukrainian members of the Waffen-SS. For World Report, I'm Dan Karpinchuk in Toronto.
Next to Australia, which will vote on October 14th in a referendum to recognise First Nations people in the Constitution by setting up a powerful parliamentary advisory body, the Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, says it would make a positive and practical difference to the lives of First Nations communities. Critics of the reform insist that it would be divisive and have little impact. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
First Nations people aren't mentioned in Australia's constitution. That could soon change. On October the 14th, a referendum will decide whether to enshrine a so-called Indigenous voice to Parliament. It would be an independent panel of Aboriginal people that would help to shape government policies and advise MPs. The Prime Minister Anthony Albanese says the vote is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to bring the country together and to change it for the better. The voice to Parliament was recommended after Indigenous leaders met in Central Australia 6 years ago. They signed the Uluru Statement from the Heart, named after the imposing sandstone rock. The document spoke of their despair at the chronic problems in their communities. First Nations Australians make up about 3% of the population, but they suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and unemployment. A third of all prisoners in Australia are Aboriginal. While it's estimated that Indigenous people live on average 8 years less than other Australians. Overcrowded housing is also a significant problem. The Prime Minister has distilled the debate about the voice. To him, it's about listening to Indigenous people and delivering better results to improve their lives and well-being. The Yes campaign says it's no longer acceptable for Australia to be one of the only colonised countries in the world that doesn't recognise Indigenous people in its founding document. Critics, though, insist the proposal is a white elitist project that won't tackle discrimination or poverty. They see the voice as divisive between Indigenous Australians and the broader population. Opponents of reform argue that the idea presumes First Nations people will always be disadvantaged and will always need to be treated differently. Others lament the lack of information about how the advisory panel would actually work and who would be on it. The government says those details would be worked out if the referendum succeeds. The No campaign is a broad church of dissenters. Some prominent Aboriginal leaders believe the voice proposal doesn't go far enough. The committee would only provide advice to governments and lawmakers, but some campaigners want it to have real independent power to veto decisions made in Parliament. Other activists don't want Indigenous Australians to be inserted into the Constitution, which they see as an illegal colonial document. Winning a referendum in Australia requires a double majority. That's a majority of the national vote of around 17.5 million voters and a majority in 4 out of the 6 states. The last referendum was in 1999, when Australian voters rejected a proposal to become a republic and sever their ties to the British monarchy. Supporters of reform argue that until the constitution recognises its original inhabitants, Australia is a nation missing its heart. For World Report, this is Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Finally, we go to the far north of Cameroon, the poorest region in the country. For many children there, getting to school means travelling long journeys on foot, and keeping those children in school is a challenge. Now, some people are turning to bicycles as the solution to that problem, with support agencies and teachers promoting the use of bicycles as a way of encouraging children to keep coming to school, as Dorcas Akupe reports from Cameroon.
15-year-old Gadi lives in a rural community in northern Cameroon. Like many young teenage girls in the area, Gadi usually has to wake up early, do her house chores, clean the dishes before embarking on a trek of 10 kilometers to get to school. She is studying at Government High School, GHS Gazawa, which is quite far from her home. She also has to walk the same distance back home again, which takes hours. She complained that trekking all the time made her reach school late. She hardly had time to do her homework and was always tired from trekking through and through. But this academic year, things have changed for Gadi. Her father bought her a bicycle. The teenager says it has greatly eased her movement to school, and as a result, she can better concentrate while in class. The far north region of Cameroon is the poorest and least educated region in the Central African nation, according to the World Bank statistics. With over 74% of the population living below €2 a day, parents find it difficult to send their children to school. And even when parents succeed to send their children to school, transporting them there daily becomes a challenge. This is because the distance from most neighboring villages to school is usually long for those who don't have a means of transport, that is about 10 to 17 kilometers. However, bicycles, which are cheaper to acquire, operate and maintain, have been of enormous help to many in several rural communities in far north Cameroon, students included. This two-wheel machine is now helping many students to go to school. Just like Gadi, Ina, a 15-year-old student, trekked for long distances to go to school. Ina says she usually trekked for 17 kilometers. She got discouraged and stopped school because she always came back late and tired. But this year, her elder brother offered her a bicycle and she has restarted school. Mayanga Kikura, student of Government Technical High School GTHS Gazawa, is from Mokom, a village that is 10 kilometers from his school. Mayanga tells World Report that it is a Herculean task to trek for 2 hours to and from school. He took out the bike for himself. The teenager says the bicycle will permit him achieve his education goals of staying in school and completing his studies. The highest official for secondary education in the far north region, Pierre Wang Bungsung, says that bicycles, when available, do play a great role in encouraging students to go to school, especially the girl child. Some non-governmental organizations, in a bid to promote education, have considered donating a number of bicycles to some schools in rural communities in the region. School authorities, like the principal of GHS Gazawa, Robert Masu, says bikes are easy to maintain and help the student arrive school early. The principal of the school says enrollment has stepped up partly to the fact that many students now come to school with their bikes. Unfortunately, not all students own bicycles. Some students still trek to school for several hours a day. The teachers are unanimous that if more students have their own bikes, learning and staying in school would be so much easier for them. They say two wheels would make a big difference keeping girls and boys in school. For World Report, I'm Dorcas Akupe in Mara, Cameroon.
Well, that's it from World Report for today. The program was edited by Elaine Devlin. If you want to listen back, you can go to rte.ie/worldreport or wherever you get your podcasts. We're back again at the same time next week. Until then, from myself, Justin McCarthy, and all the team, thanks for listening and take care.